Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I go deep into the archives today to bring you my 2002 conversation with Thomas Homer Dixon on his book, The Ingenuity Gap, in which he asks whether we're going to be able to generate and implement useful ideas fast enough to solve the problems we ourselves create. Problems like the surveillance capitalism of Facebook and Google, the jobs lost to robots, and the crisis of climate change. In it, he says there's still time, but the hour's getting late. And that was 17 years ago.
Is our world becoming too complex and too fast-paced to manage? Don't most of us really suspect that experts don't really know what's going on anymore, and that we've released forces that are now far beyond our control? Looking back from the year 2100, will we see a period when our creations, technological, social, ecological, outstripped our understanding, and we lost control of our destiny? And will we think, or will our children or our grandchildren think, if only we'd had the ingenuity and the will to choose a different course? Can we create and implement useful ideas fast enough to solve the very problems we've created? In his new book, The Ingenuity Gap, tonight's guest, Thomas Homer Dixon, says there's still time to muster that ingenuity and will, but that the hour is late. Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new and innovative and provocative models in business, environment, health, science, politics, and media. It's all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how and share that with you. Thomas Homer Dixon is currently the director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program and associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Toronto. He's led several international research projects examining the links between environmental stress and violence in developing countries. In recent years, his research has begun to focus on how societies adapt to complex economic, ecological, and technological change. His earlier books include Environment, Scarcity, and Violence, and Eco-Violence, Links Among Environment, Population, and Security. Now, Homer Dixon's been invited to speak on these ideas at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Oxford, Cambridge, West Point, the World Economic Forum in Davos, and the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, how would such a list be complete without KPFK? Welcome, Thomas, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Hi.
And shall I call you Thomas, Tad? What do you want?
Call me Tad.
Okay, Tad. My first question, as it always is on Free Forum, is what was your own personal path to the work that you do today and the ideas that you're focusing on? And I know in your book, The Ingenuity Gap, you weave your own personal stories in the course of dealing with those big ideas. And so feel free to go back as far as you want, take as long as you wish, childhood dreams, mentors, models, turning points. And what we do is we just want listeners to get to know the people as well as the ideas and the work that we're talking about here. Take it.
Okay. I think any person's intellectual development is long and twisted, and often I think we don't really understand how we got to the point where we are now. My early interests, going back to my childhood, were in the sort of natural environment and the outdoors. I grew up in Victoria, British Columbia, in an area outside the city, in a rural area. And my father was a forester, but he was concerned very much with ecologically safe forestry. He was one of the pioneers of clean logging in a lot of ways. And so I was introduced to a notion of sustainability early in my childhood and spent a lot of time outdoors. My mother was an artist and just had a voracious appetite for ideas and information from all different domains, science, literature, and otherwise. And I think early on, growing up in this very peaceful, absolutely picturesque, beautiful environment, and my parents were very aware of sort of global affairs and current affairs, talked about them a lot, I always felt that there was a kind of stark and quite bizarre contrast between what seemed to be happening in the rest of the world and the quite idyllic life we were leading in Victoria. And so I became interested early on in essentially the causes of conflict, what led people to fight each other in big conflicts such as the world wars, but also in revolutions and civil violence and ethnic violence, all the way down to interpersonal conflicts. That was one of my first interests. And another interest that was longstanding, in part because I grew up in an outdoor area, was my concern for the environment and interest in environmental and issues of nature in general. Now, eventually, after a long period of time of sort of higher education, going to various universities, I ended up at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And in my dissertation, I was focusing principally on the cause of ethnic strife, we-they conflicts, or conflicts between us and them, and looking at some very interesting theories about that. But I brought in, eventually, the environmental issues. And subsequent to my PhD research, I started to focus principally on the links between environmental stress and violence in developing countries. So how, for instance, is water scarcity, or how could water scarcity lead to revolutions or insurgencies or riots or ethnic clashes among groups in poor countries around the world? We also looked at land scarcity, cropland scarcity, shortages of forests and fuel wood and fish stocks around the world, and how those affected basically hundreds of millions of people in different countries and regions. Now, you know, one of the interesting issues that we encountered, and when I say we, I had a fairly large research team at this point involved in these issues through the 1990s.
And this is why you're still at MIT working on PhD?
Well,
or this is after?
Yeah. Well, eventually I left MIT and I came to the University of Toronto, and I raised money from various foundations, mm-hmm. mostly American foundations, to investigate this issue of environment and conflict, which had not been explored at all. And one of the issues that was really critical right at the beginning was the question of adaptation. It's clear that some societies can adapt reasonably well to environmental stress. They might have a water scarcity, but they adjust their technologies and institutions. They might introduce, say, water conservation technologies in the field, irrigation technologies that use less water, even drip irrigation, for example. They might change their institutions, their social institutions. They might, for instance, price water differently so that people are encouraged to conserve it and get out of say, water-intensive crops like citrus crops or growing tomatoes or something like that. Now, some societies could adjust well, and other societies didn't adjust well at all. And it was those societies in the latter group that were vulnerable to various kinds of social breakdown, impoverishment, and eventually perhaps violence. Now, the question then was, why do some societies go down one path, the adaptation path, and some go down the other path of not being able to adapt and eventually perhaps suffering some kind of major breakdown? And that was the origin of my thinking about what I call ingenuity, basically the how we deliver ideas or solutions to deal with the challenges we face. I developed this set of ideas, this theory of ingenuity, to deal with a problem within my research on environment conflict. But I think, you know, what happens when you focus on anything for a long period of time, you start to see it everywhere. And I was kind of monomaniacal about this whole thing, and I started to see ingenuity problems all over the place. And I realized I could apply this general theory to more issues beyond environmental issues and beyond poor countries. And that's what my latest book does. It tries to develop a general theory for adaptation to social stress. How do societies adjust to complex and rapid change?
Okay, let me tell people, you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM. And this evening we're speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon, author of The Ingenuity Gap, How Can We Solve the Problems of the Future? And you can learn more about Thomas and his work at www.homerdixon, one word, HOMERDIXON, homerdixon.com. Okay, so that was interesting. You wove that very well. So you were looking first at conflict.
That's right.
Then the relationship of conflict and the environment.
That's right.
And then the difference in when environmental problems are more likely to lead to conflict, and that opened up the whole arena of this ingenuity or ingenuity gap. And again, what do you mean by ingenuity? It's not a word that everyone uses all the time, even though we all know it.
It's interesting. Some people even have trouble pronouncing the word, I find, because it isn't used terribly frequently in our day-to-day conversation. By ingenuity, I mean ideas that are applied to solve practical, social, and technical problems. So you can think of these ideas as sets of instructions or almost recipes for how we might go about solving a problem. So if you're addressing, as I suggested before, you're addressing a problem such you face frequently in California of water scarcity, you can address that in various ways. You can develop certain technologies, and the technologies will consist of literally a set of instructions. You know, you do this and then you do that, and after that you do something else, and hopefully that solves the water scarcity problem. But ingenuity can also consist of ideas for institutions. How, for instance, you arrange your water markets in California to make sure that water is priced so that people conserve it effectively. This is a problem, of course, you faced with your energy supply in California recently.
Yeah.
So ingenuity comes in two forms. It comes in what I call technical ingenuity, ideas to solve technical problems, and social ingenuity, ideas to solve social problems, ideas in particular for institutions, how we arrange ourselves in our institutions to solve our problems collectively.
And would you agree that most people have more of the technical connotation to the word ingenuity?
Yes.
And that perhaps one of the things you're shining a light on is that the best laid technical plans are not enough?
Well, human beings are very good at technology. They're not so good at the social institutions and social arrangements. But one of the things that this whole body of thinking has come up with, and it's not just my work, but I think the work of many other people, is that ultimately the institutions are more important than the technologies, because you don't get the flow of technologies you want. You don't get those, say, water conservation or energy conservation technologies in California unless you, in particular, get the prices for those resources right. And you don't get the prices right unless you arrange your market institutions correctly, because your markets have to give the right price signals to the technological entrepreneurs so they go out and take the risk to develop new technologies. So it turns out that for a whole variety of reasons, institutions are precursors to the flow of technology. So what I would call social ingenuity is a precursor to technical ingenuity. Now, we're not terribly good at developing institutions, and in fact, our knowledge base for developing institutions, the social sciences, are woefully, you might say, ill-equipped or inadequate in producing the kind of knowledge that we would need to develop new institutions to deal with a lot of the complex problems we face, such as global climate change or rising antibiotic-resistant diseases or homelessness in our cities or healthcare crises in Western countries.
Now, let me
we're not very good at adjusting our institutions to deal with those problems, and social science doesn't help us very much with that frequently.
Now, I'm sure you've thought about why that is. Now, one thing that occurs to me is that the key social lever, it seems to me, is, as you said before, it's the economics. And is there... And it's an interesting chicken and egg kind of thing, I think, here, that the way that we structure our markets, the way we structure our incentives, is a social technique, involves social ingenuity.
Yes.
But if our markets and our economic incentives are focused on the social problems of how do we sell more products or put more fannies in the seats of a theater, and not on how we stimulate conservation and so on, is part of the problem of why it seems that our social ingenuity lags behind, that there's not a market incentive for certain kinds of social ingenuity.
I think that's right. Now, you have to develop your institutions within a broader political context through which people decide, hopefully collectively through a democratic process, what their goals are, what values they want to pursue, and then the institutions ideally would arise from that sort of democratic consensus that develops about the general social goals and values. and then you have institutions that would hopefully help you achieve those goals and values. Now, unfortunately, what happens in a lot of cases is that process is derailed, and it's derailed by powerful vested interests and special interests that intervene to protect their particular slice of the pie. There could be, for instance, groups of consumers of water resources that are dependent upon cheap water. And of course, they don't want to see any, even if there's a more general social consensus on the need for higher water prices to encourage conservation, the groups that are dependent upon cheap water don't want to see the situation change. Now, if they're particularly powerful, and this depends sometimes on fairly idiosyncratic things about the society in question, but sometimes these groups can be very powerful, they can have a tremendous amount of influence at the elite levels of a society, and they can block institutional reform. They can block the market reform that you need. So one of the things I talk about in my book at length is how our political process might be changing that, so that this kind of gridlock is more common than it has been in the past. I mean, we've always had political gridlock, but I think in some respects it's becoming more common.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell people again, you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM. I'm Terry McNally, and we're joined this evening by Thomas Homer Dixon, author of The Ingenuity Gap, How Can We Solve the Problems of the Future? And I'd almost say it's also, can we solve the problems of the future?
And you can learn. How was added by my editor against my wishes. So I wanted it to be, can we solve the problems of the future? So let's go with that.
Okay. There's an intuition for you. And you can learn more about his ideas at www.homerdixon.com. Okay. When we get down to where we're talking right now, at the point that you were saying, you know, society has to set up its social institutions, political institutions, in order to, you know, promote certain things. That was when it began to sound abstract and idealistic, because it looks now, I mean, and I don't suppose this is true all over the world, but my guess would be getting ever more so, that in America, I think one could easily say that the cost of television advertising is the single most important factor in our political process. And that when you work backwards from that, that, you know, it then becomes about raising money rather than raising ideas. It becomes about proposing or doing the bidding of those, whatever interests will get you the money to get the advertising. And that there's a breakdown there. Now, where do you see leverage for solution in that?
Well, I think this is a very good question. I think our political systems, and this is a particularly acute problem in the United States, our political systems are becoming more, in a sense, beholden to wealth. And because of the cost of advertising, because of the cost of trying to reach a mass audience, and because of a kind of fundraising arms race among candidates, you get a situation where I think the interests of powerful funders and of big funders are overrepresented within our political and social systems. Now, that's not always a bad thing, but I think it produces a kind of rigidity within our social system, so that in a time of crisis, in many cases, or in times of severe stress or complex change, rapid change, in many cases, those powerful vested interests, those powerful economic interests, aren't going to be willing to pursue the kinds of big changes and accept the kinds of big changes that the society may need to undertake. What you want to do within a society in a situation of rapid change, which is what we face today, is encourage a lot of sort of a fluorescence of ideas across the society and the open democratic discussion of those ideas in lots of places, with hopefully some of them will percolate to the top of the system and will be accepted and implemented. And I see, unfortunately, our systems more and more shutting down that kind of discussion and becoming more narrow and more rigid. Now, one of the things that people might say as a way of dealing with this is that this is what the Internet is about. The Internet allows this fluorescence of discussion, communication among all kinds of individuals at the local and in a sense, low level, not the high level of society, but just among themselves, and the development of new ideas. But yet we're seeing with the Internet, some of the recent research suggests that the Internet is not is not producing as much of a fluorescence of ideas as we would expect. People tend to go to the same old sites. They tend to follow the well-worn pathways of information retrieval and go to the same places more or less for their sources of information. And those big sites are, of course, ultimately dominated by powerful economic interests within our society.
Yeah, and I would say, why would we be surprised? They tend to go to the same places for their hamburgers, for their Gap clothes, for their Nike tennis shoes.
There's an interesting phenomenon here that there's been some recent research published on this. When people have a plethora of choices, sort of an almost an infinite range of choices in front of them, their decisions tend to narrow and they focus on a narrow range of options. You know what it's like. You go into a drugstore or something and you see 100 brands of toothpaste in front of you and you think, oh boy, you can't deal with all of this. You just say, okay, I want Colgate or Crest because I've always used that and I won't bother looking at all the rest. If you had only 6 choices, you might experiment a little bit. And it's very interesting that the overwhelming amount of information, the overwhelming options that we have now, in part because of these new technologies, information technologies in particular, actually causes us to become in a sense, less curious and less inclined to explore in some cases, and it narrows our focus in some ways because we're simply overwhelmed most of the time.
That makes very good sense to me. So in other words, the internet in its earlier days probably had more experimentation and probably had something to do with the kind of people that were drawn to it early.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And my guess is even, I would wonder about this, but in a small town or in a town pre-fast food, perhaps people actually roamed from restaurant to restaurant more likely. You know, it really makes sense what you're saying. And so it seems like, again, that's very much a self-fulfilling kind of a cycle.
Well, it's bad news in a way. And there was a front page article in the New York Times recently about this research that suggested that, surprise, surprise, there seems to be a drop in exploration, curiosity, and sort of poking around the web over the last couple of years. The people are not using it to expand their minds as much as was hoped and expand their information sources. I think this is simply a function of the fact that we now are so busy, most of us are so busy, we've got so many things we have to deal with, there's so many options available to us, so many streams of information coming into our lives, that we just don't want a lot of choice. We retreat to the things we know well.
Yeah. No, I think it's very true. I find myself wanting to go in two very different directions, and so I'm going to do them in sequence. One is to focus a little bit more on the political, okay? And I have the image that the current administration in America, the Bush administration in Washington, is the 20th century reaching up from out of the grave and grabbing us by the throat, you know, refusing to die, that as conflicted and disappointing as the Clinton-Gore administration was, that it was in a way, even as they said, a bridge to the 21st century.
And it was in a sense a reflection of a conflicted and complex world.
Yes, about that transition.
Yeah.
Now, they made Bridge to the 21st Century a slogan, but in some sense, given the challenges they faced and the political whatever and their own will, they seldom, I think, performed like they really took that seriously. Okay?
Yes.
You've advised Al Gore. You know, in one bio I saw it said, you know, an advisor to the Clinton administration. What do you think of that take, you know, of the 20th versus the 21st? And can you tell me why that happened, and why, for instance, what we were saying about the political process ending up speaking to the special interests, I know personally and from reading that Al Gore understands much of what we're talking about, and yet if you watched the campaign, that was not very apparent. Let me tell people before you start, you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM. I'm Terry McNally. And we're speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon, author of The Ingenuity Gap. Can we solve the problems of the future? Okay.
Wow. Now, that was a very broad-reaching question. Let me take a couple of cuts at it here. The George W. Bush administration looks pretty scary to a lot of people outside the United States. I think in Europe there is serious concern. There's a widening gulf, I think, between the political culture in Canada and the United States. I think Americans should be aware that they're not on the same track as a lot of the rest of the world. At least this administration in particular isn't on the same track. And I think you're right that it's a bit of a throwback. I think there's a desire among people in a world that seems very perplexing to have simplicity, to have straightforward, no-nonsense proposals. They don't want somebody like Al Gore to come out and say, well, you know, it's a complicated problem, and we probably have to do a bunch of things simultaneously to deal with it, whatever the problem is. And here are some of the issues that you need to think about, because I want advice from you as to which things you really prefer to do. But people don't want that. They want to be able to hand all the problems over to politicians who say, we're going to fix it. We're going to we got these simple ideas and straightforward ideas that are sort of down-home remedies, and we're going to fix these problems. And then the public doesn't want to think about it anymore. Yet our democracy now, because of the nature of the challenges we're facing, requires greater responsibility and greater input from citizens, greater reflection, a greater dedication of time on the part of individual citizens to learn about issues and think about them and discuss them among each other. Unfortunately, what we're seeing in many cases is exactly the opposite. Again, because of information overload, we're seeing the amount of time devoted to the discussion of any one issue shrinking. We've all heard about the shrinking soundbite on television. It's gone from 30 seconds to 8 seconds in the last 30 years or something. What's less well known is that the length of news articles in our newspapers and opinion pieces in our newspapers has dropped dramatically. Cover stories in Time magazine have dropped almost 40% in length in the last 30 years. So we actually have less time to talk about and less space to talk about and reflect on more complex issues that should require more time and more space. I think in this kind of world, people reach out for simplicity. I think that's part of what's happened in the United States. And more specifically, and I guess you could say idiosyncratically, the particular election in the United States that we've just seen was, I think, in part a rejection of the Clinton years. Clinton was still popular in the public opinion polls, but a lot of people were dissatisfied with what had happened, a lot of the scandals over the previous 8 years. And I think that was it was actually a much tougher election for Al Gore than people, most of the pundits have asserted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's a tough one to argue, because I felt that. That between Alan Tipper and Joe Lieberman and Hadassah, there was a pretty good inoculation against that. If one had done, I mean, I think to have run, I think it would have been possible, as simplistic as people want it. I thought it would have been possible to run against his behavior and with his prosperity.
But here's a kind of the example of kind of thing I'm talking about. There was one critical issue, or there were several critical issues during the campaign, but one that really put Gore in a difficult position, and that was the rising gasoline prices. Now, we know what Gore really believes about this. He really believes, as most economists believe, that it's a good thing to have gasoline prices go up, because it will encourage all kinds of technical innovation, and it will eventually reduce our carbon dioxide output and perhaps help us deal with global warming.
Yeah, one of the first ideas they didn't go through with was the BTU tax back in 92.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But that came right out of Gore's brain trust, in a sense. Well, of course, if Gore had come out and said, you know, people, you may not like this, but what we really need is a doubling of gasoline prices, because that's going to make this country much more efficient, much more entrepreneurial, and over the long run, we're going to have a much more stable ecological future, he would have lost the election by 30 points.
Mm-hmm.
So who's at fault here? Is it Gore, or is it the public that is holding two contradictory ideas simultaneously in its mind? We want low gasoline prices, and we want the politicians to deal with global warming, but don't touch our gasoline prices.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody actually connects those two issues and says to the public, you know, you're actually thinking in a contradictory way, and before I do anything, you're going to have to work this out.
Yeah.
you're either going to have to live with global warming or you're going to have to live with higher gasoline prices, one or the other. They reject it. They throw them out. They throw the politician out.
Yeah.
And that's not Gore's fault. We get, in a sense, the kind of politicians we deserve. And I'm afraid that's part of what's happened in the United States.
Yeah. In other words, by the way, in my question of why he didn't express what we know he understands, I was not saying, you know, that he was absolutely at fault for doing that. I know that it is a system which promotes that.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2002 conversation with Thomas Homer Dixon on his book, The Ingenuity Gap, in which he asks whether we're going to generate and implement useful ideas fast enough to solve the problems we ourselves create.
I'm Terry McNally, and Thomas is the author of The Ingenuity Gap, Can We Solve the Problems of the Future? And we are looking at what he has termed the ingenuity gap, which is as we need more and better and novel ideas to deal with the problems we have created, are we actually promoting the emergence of those kind of ideas? Do we have systems in place, or are we even creating them that will allow us to solve problems as fast as we can create them? Is that a pretty accurate way of putting it?
That's pretty good. The ingenuity gap is the gap between our rising need for solutions to our problems and our sometimes inadequate ability to supply those solutions.
Okay, let me go back to the other end from a very, you know, recent current event story and ask one of these sort of bigger questions. James Thornton, I don't know if you know who he is. He's formerly an undefeated NRDC litigator, mm-hmm. won a lot of cases against the government and corporations, and then retired from that field and wrote a book called Field Guide to the Soul. Mm-hmm. One of the first things he did in there was he offered what he believes is the conventional origin story, as all societies have had an origin story, what he thinks society, American, and as I say, American spreading beyond America, tacitly believes, even though it's not what they say, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that story included the fact that though we may not say it, we really don't believe we're going to make it. He wrote it this way. In the middle of the story, he said, quote, "We have not been equipped by evolution with the tools to solve the global problems we have caused. We will probably destroy ourselves and much or all of life on Earth in the next 100 years, if not sooner."
Now, this is he's saying this is a perspective that's widely held within the population?
Yes.
Or this is his own perspective?
No. His perspective is different.
Mm-hmm.
What he was saying was that people don't say it, but if you look at their behavior, if you look at many of the things we've been talking about, that because of this underlying, almost secret, tacit belief, we let our lives be about consumption and distraction.
Well,
what do you think?
Oh, boy. It would be easy to accept that argument. I guess I've got a more benign interpretation of human beings. I think it goes back to something I was sort of suggesting before. I think it's actually quite easy for all of us, and a lot of the time in our lives, to have mutually contradictory ideas in our head and information in our heads, and not spend the time to work out those contradictions, to realize they're there and then resolve them in one way or the other. Partly because life is full of ambiguities and a lot of those contradictions will go away if we just ignore them. Things change over time. And most of us, thank God, aren't compulsive enough that we really worry about these things all that much. And we just live with the ambiguities of life and the contradictions of life. But I think, so what does this mean in terms of what he was writing? I think...
Or let me just say, by the way, Ted, I have found myself thinking that as well. It's why I drew on his quote, which is, if we really thought, it's like me sort of calling to the people saying, if you really thought we're going to make it through this, wouldn't we be aiming higher? Wouldn't we be doing, you know, if we really thought that we had the power to change things, wouldn't we be behaving differently?
I think most people deal with the kind of contradiction I was talking about before between global warming and gasoline prices.
Yeah.
By accepting a number of escape routes that are sort of intellectual escape routes that are offered by some very prominent and powerful opinion leaders in our societies. For instance, In the United States, one of the most important intellectual escape routes is what I would call sort of the necessity will be the mother of invention escape route. Basically, the idea that when the problems get bad, we'll tech fix our way out of this. We'll develop a technology, we'll throw science at the problem, and we'll deal with the problem that way. And so many times in the past, the United States has been able to surmount unbelievable challenges in exactly that way. The Panama Canal, the Manhattan Project, the Apollo Project, for example. And this is a very convenient, assumption to adopt, especially when it's being espoused by some very prominent people in society. So you can go on living your life the way it is. You can continue to drive your SUV. And you can say, well, you know, when things get really bad, I am concerned about global warming, sure, but when things get really bad, they'll develop a new vehicle that that gives me all the services I want because they say they can do this, and that doesn't destroy the environment. So the real, in some sense, some of the moral responsibility for this situation we find ourselves in rests with people who are, I think, in a somewhat deceitful way, providing those intellectual escape routes. And that's actually what I go after in my book. I challenge that argument that necessity will be the mother of invention. Directly.
In other words, the ingenuity gap is more crucial because ingenuity has been successful. If it had never been successful, we wouldn't rely on it and the gap wouldn't be as important.
Exactly. We sort of have a track record, and if we're selective, we can look at that track record and say, wow, we can solve just about any problem we've ever faced. But if you really look carefully at the track record without being selective, you realize that sometimes we can and sometimes we can't. And there's no guarantee we're going to be able to solve these problems by using science and technology in the future. Some of them we will, some of them we probably won't. We're betting an awful lot of the well-being of our children and our children's children on their capacity to invent scientific solutions to the problems that we give them.
Yeah.
Now, that's... If you want to mobilize people, if you want to develop a more benign interpretation of human beings, or see some, in a sense, moral hope in our societies, talk about children, people's children and their grandchildren. That's what extends their horizon beyond the next tank of gasoline and the price of that gasoline, beyond the next 4-year period election cycle, out 10, 15, 20, maybe even 100 years if you're talking about your grandchildren. And I find I reach people when I do that,
mm-hmm.
because we all are concerned about our children. And that's, it's a funny sort of thing, you know, about children. You know, usually they're brought into the world as an act of selfishness, and then it becomes a 25-year exercise in altruism afterwards.
Right. I'm some of the most altruistic among us. Friends of mine who are, you know, passionately concerned with the environment, choose not to have children. I mean,
well,
that doesn't go across the board, but it's a sad state.
Having a child is a vote for the future.
Absolutely.
Now, what you need to get across to people is say, the future could be bright, but we have to take seriously these problems now, and let's not be deceitful with ourselves, and let's not delude ourselves that they're going to be easy to solve when the crisis arises.
Yeah.
In many ways, my book is about being proactive, or as sometimes I put it with my audiences, trying to re-ennoble the concept of prudence and a certain sense of humility about what we can accomplish. We're extraordinary creatures, but we can't do anything we set our minds to.
Right. One of the things you were saying, when you look at the track record, yes, we can find places ingenuity didn't save us, but we got here. And I think it is easy, without being incredibly selective, to say we got to a pretty good place. I know that, you know, there's many gaps where that's not true. But the difference also you're saying is that even if ingenuity's been successful up to this point, that perhaps something has changed in the nature of the problems we face,
yeah,
and that it has to do with complexity and scale. I correct?
And speed. That's exactly right. The world is different now. In fact, one of the opening chapters of the book is titled Our New World, and it's about why we have to start thinking about things differently because our world is different. Now, of course, throughout history, people have always thought that they're living on the cusp of chaos, and the world that they're in is one that's never been seen before.
Certainly, they felt that in 1900. I mean,
that's right, and sometimes those claims were reasonable and legitimate, and sometimes they weren't. The claim I'm making now, I think, can be objectively justified in a number of ways. One would be to look at what we're doing to the planet's environment. This is the first time in the history of our species that we have the ability to change the fundamental dynamics of the planet's ecosystem, and we're doing so. We've doubled the amount of reactive nitrogen in the planet's environment. We've added 30% to the concentrations of carbon dioxide in the planet's atmosphere. We've destroyed a continent-size patch of ozone over the Antarctic. It's a good thing it happened over the Antarctic. Boy, we would be a lot worse off if it happened over, say, North America.
Well, actually, we probably wouldn't. Because
might have been galvanized to do something.
As it began to happen over North America, something would have moved. Let me tell people again, this is Free Forum, KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, talking with Tom or Homer Dixon. I'm Terry McNally, and we're talking about why humanity's successful track record, apparently successful track record with coming up with solutions and magnificent ingenuity, is being tested in a way that perhaps has never been so. And I don't want to interrupt you, but to go exactly with what you said, in the book, one of the wilder things you point out is that we have the capacity to turn around the currents of the North Atlantic, which could flip the whole climate for Europe. And at the moment that I read that, I said, how real or likely is that? And why don't people know this? In other words, what's going on?
Well, it's interesting. There actually was a cover story in the Atlantic Monthly about it a couple of years ago, but it isn't well known in general. One of the consequences of global warming may be a reorganization of the currents in the North Atlantic, which could literally reorganize energy flows around the planet and could paradoxically throw Europe into a deep freeze because energy transfer would stop from the tropics up to the poles. The issue here, though, is we see that this has happened in the historical record by looking at our records of climate, and we can gain records of climate by looking at tree rings and things like that going back a long, long time. We see that this has happened before. We suspect that it happens when the mean temperature of the planet changes a few degrees for a variety of reasons that I talk about in the book. But we can't predict exactly when it's going to happen. So in a sense, human beings have developed this capacity to reorganize things on the planet, to push the ecosystem and the complex environmental systems on the planet into a new equilibrium. But we can't direct that process. We can, in a sense, wreck. We can't construct. This is not about building a new environment for ourselves. It's about pushing it into a situation that may be different from anything human beings have had to deal with in their history in terms of climates around the planet. And that's something that's new. That's something that we've never been able to do before. We've never had that capacity. I can go on about disappearance of frogs around the world, the death of coral reefs around the planet, fisheries. 70% of the fisheries on the planet have been exhausted or overfished. It goes on and on. But there's something else that's new, and this, I think, is more real to people in their everyday lives, and that is the rising, you mentioned this, the rising complexity of our world. And I would argue, and I do argue in the book, that we're now starting to create systems and circumstances for ourselves that are so complex that they exceed the ability of our brains to manage them. And so there's been a threshold, in a sense. We've crossed what you might call a complexity threshold. And, you know, here's a sort of a first-hand example. It appears from brain research that human beings are able to track the social behavior and have significant knowledge of about 150 individuals. Now, that was perfectly adequate as long as we lived within, say, villages and small towns. Probably it was perfectly adequate until well into the 1900s. But now we have the technological ability to have essentially an infinite community. Now, one of the reasons a lot of us feel overwhelmed all the time is because when we sit down with our email in the morning, there are people from around the world who can get hold of us. lots of us receive 40, 50, 60 emails a day. Cell phones are ringing, our phones are ringing all the time. We have a social community that now quite possibly exceeds the basic capacity of our brains to manage. And that's just in one aspect of our lives. In so many things that we're doing, we seem to be pushing the limits of our cognitive ability. And that's new, too, I would say.
Yep. And let me shift again, or just go back a little bit to what you were saying. It's funny that I tend to think that you and I both agree that the situation that we're talking about is not an environmental problem. By that I mean I mean that what people assume is, well, that's environmental issues, environmental problems. This is an environmental program, anything like that. Correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Not just an environment. It's a broader issue. I talk about it as how we adapt to complex and rapid change.
Yeah.
And of all kinds, economic, technological, environmental. And what I realized as I was doing all my work on the environment that I was talking about early in the show was that this was only one slice of a broader set of issues that had to be addressed.
Yeah, in a way, it seems to me the environment is both the easiest one to see it in. I mean, it's very easy. We can tick off soil, fisheries, boom, 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 global warming. But also the one that, in some sense, unless it's a local problem of water quality or air quality, is still removed from people. The other ones, the overwhelm of information, the overwhelm of social interaction, the overwhelm. I heard a report yesterday that you may have heard this British study that children now play outside and play with other children less, by huge rates, less than they used to in Britain. That this past summer they spent, you know, this little portion of time with other children because they spent much more time in front of screens,
right,
where the message is instant gratification, where the message is consume and so on. And nature and other children, which was so vital to developing, I think, the kinds of things that actually get us in touch with the need to solve some of these problems, is losing out. You and I have spoken in a previous conversation about how humans kind of got this way, and that one of the things was that for most of our existence, we felt fragile, vulnerable, and an underdog, and that we haven't accustomed ourselves yet to that we're not the underdog anymore, and that matched with that is an arrogance. And when you put the feeling that I'm a victim and I'm arrogant, that's pretty dangerous.
Yeah, the combination of a sense of insecurity with arrogance is a dangerous combination. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's only been in the last 100 years or so that human beings have developed these abilities to dominate the planet's environment and the natural surroundings. We've made significant local changes in our environments for millennia, but at the planetary scale, never before. In fact, you could say that it's only within the last 30 to 40 years. That's a blink of the eye compared to even human history, which is, say, 10,000 years or so. And if you look at the history of the species or the existence of the species, 100,000 years, hominids, 3 million years, this 40 years is just a blink of the eye. And we're still behaving basically as if the planet were infinite and as if it were, in many respects, as if nature were constantly a mortal threat to our existence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not realizing that at the moment we're posing a mortal threat to nature in a lot of ways, at least to many of the systems, natural systems around us. And that's a real problem, that insecurity. At the same time, interestingly, we're tremendously arrogant about our accomplishments and what we've managed to achieve and this sense that we can always work it out in the future.
Yeah, going back,
I'm not sure that's true for all societies.
It's right.
Particularly true within the United States, with a tremendous sense of optimism and can-do attitude towards the world, which is, of course, one of the sources of American prosperity and all the achievements of America. But these two things together, the technological arrogance and the sense of insecurity in the face of nature, are, as you pointed out, very dangerous combinations.
Yeah, one thing else this keeps bumping up in my head as we're talking is that there's a funny paradox in that we don't seem to be responding to incremental changes, and yet things are changing faster than ever. Do you
That's
get what
right.
I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. We are hardwired, and I think the point that you made before about the question of whether we have derived from our evolutionary heritage the capability of dealing with the kind of world we've created for ourselves, I think is a valid point. We are hardwired to respond to sharp, rapid changes. The sudden appearance of a predator, for example. And we're not very good at responding proactively to slow incremental changes. In fact, what we do to incremental change is adapt. And you can go around the world. You know, I've traveled a lot in the developing world. I have a chapter in the book about traveling in India. And you see people who've adapted to the most, what we consider the most horrific circumstances imaginable. And yet human beings have been very good at that. And that's one of the reasons we've prospered. It's kind of a capacity to maintain hope, even in impossible circumstances.
And I've heard it in your last two answers that I'm ending up in this conversation, Tad, of being more and more sort of, not quite overwhelmed, but really struck by the ambiguities and the paradoxes, that feeling of optimism is probably a crucial ingredient to ingenuity as well.
Yes, it's a crucial ingredient to working our way out of this box. I wouldn't want to sacrifice it. But again, to get back to what I suggested before, the first step for us has to be to be more humble about our capacity, and in a sense to re-ennoble this concept of prudence, to realize that if we wait too long, we may not be able to solve a lot of these problems effectively, that we need to act in the foreground rather than later. And that's something that historically we aren't tremendously good at, but we need to learn fast now. I think we have the capacity to do it, and that comes perhaps from my own hardwired optimism.
Do you see any signs?
Yes, I do, actually. I think that there's a very significant struggle between groups that would like to maintain the current course and extrapolate things more or less as they are constantly into the future, and groups that believe, for various reasons, that there need to be fundamental changes. It's not clear how that's going to work out in the end, but I hope that I have the optimism to hope that there's some brighter future for us.
So I heard you there beginning to go to, and this is something that we've got about 5.5 minutes that I want us to touch on, is what are the diagnosis is, and we're not dealing with the prognosis. The diagnosis is tough. And what are some of the prescriptions? So one is to step back, just as Bill Joy said in his Wired article a year and a half or so. What else?
Well, step back to realize, let not kid ourselves about the size of these problems. We face monumental challenges in a lot of areas. To recognize that what it seems that we're doing around the planet in just about all domains of human activity, it's as if we've got our foot slammed to the floor, the accelerator pressed hard to the floor, and we're doing as much as we can, as fast as we can, of everything we can in every domain of human activity, whether it's economic, technological, ecological, or whatever. And part of the argument that I'm suggesting is that we need to start thinking constructively about slowing things down, about reducing the rate at which our need for solutions to our problems is rising, our ingenuity requirement is rising. Now, that's, of course, pretty controversial, and especially, I think, in Western societies, which are built around a concept of progress and built around a concept of constant dynamism and change.
And certainly economically so.
Absolutely. And we have developed some of the most nimble and adaptive societies in human history. But that doesn't mean that we are going to be able to adapt to all of the challenges we're creating for ourselves.
So there's going to be a need for a social, let me just say, so it's going to be a need for a social ingenuity that can allow us to find a way to slow down.
And this leads to the second thing.
Okay.
A lot of what slowing down is about is addressing our underlying value premises, what it is that we mean by the good life, what we're thinking of when we imagine the good life. And my sense is that many of us are leading lives right now which are focused on consumption, which are incredibly hectic, where we have remarkably little time for the people in our lives who we care about the most. These are lives that don't reflect what we perceive in our minds would be the good life. And yet there hasn't developed within our societies, I think, a broader consensus over where we should go, what the alternatives would be. If we're going to actively think about stepping back, taking our foot off that accelerator, we have to have a sense for what alternative kind of society we're going to create for ourselves, what alternative world we're going to create for ourselves. Now, unfortunately, our market economy right at the moment encourages that kind of constant acceleration of pace, because any one economic actor is competing with other economic actors, and if they don't adopt the latest technology and act faster than their others, they're going to lose in the economic competition. So we're probably looking at some pretty fundamental questions about the nature of capitalism, the nature of our markets, if we're going to go back to some of those questions about what is the good life. But we're not even asking them effectively now. The first step would be to ask them. And there's one other thing I think has got to be a starting point for addressing some of these issues. As a species, we're not going to be able to address them if we're divided up into 1,000 little groups, all with our own sort of internally reinforced identities, and trying to pursue our narrow interests as groups. It's really critical to deal with something like global warming, for example, that we have a species-wide sense of identity, a common sense of humanity, a common sense of we-ness, that we're all, in a sense, in this leaky lifeboat together, and we're going to have to make some hard trade-offs for each other. We're actually going to have to probably make some sacrifices for each other along the way. Right at the moment, that idea, especially, I'm afraid, with the current American administration, is so far from realization that it's scary, and yet that is going to be a starting point for addressing a lot of the challenges we face.
Yeah, I hear you probably know Robert Wright's book, Non-Zero.
Yeah.
Robert was on the program a short time ago. In other words, he says that war, while it's a divisive thing between the two warring parties, brings together the individual parties, right?
Yeah.
It causes, and so if we could recognize the threats we pose to ourselves, environmentally, socially, and so on, then that could lead us to cooperate more and realize we're in this together.
Right. Now, let's hope that's possible. It's an interesting question. I mean, we've seen the enemy, and he is us, as Walt Kelly used to
yep.
say. And can we be encouraged to cooperate when the opponent, in a sense, is not outside us, an implacable and ferocious enemy outside us, but is a set of forces that we are producing ourselves? We are living. And one of the really exciting things about being around right now is we are living in one of the most remarkable times in human history. And in many ways, the nature of our species and the trajectory it follows for millennia to come will probably be decided in the next century or so.
Let's leave it at that. We're just about at the end. What I want to say to listeners is that the book, The Ingenuity Gap by Thomas Homer Dixon, not only deals in all these big ideas we've dealt with, but is based on a structure of personal stories that makes it it's not just an abstract book of theory. It's a very readable personal story. We could go for another hour easy, and there were many questions that I had actually thought to pose that we didn't get a chance to. So thank you, Thomas Homer Dixon.
Thank you.
To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. You've been listening to Free Forum. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.